Hinterland, What We Do When We're Not Doing What We Do, in which I get to ask people where they escape to, where they escape the pressures of everyday life, the routine of it all. Is it something they do? Is it somewhere they go? Is it something they listen to, something they read? That's what this podcast will be all about. My name is Jeremy Harmer, and in each episode, I'll be asking people about what it is they do, where they come from, and then where they go. That is, if they go anywhere. We've got some fabulous guests, and for me, recording these podcasts has been one of the most enjoyable things I've ever been involved in, and I hope you feel the same way. So let's get going. My first guest on My Hinterland is violinist, super looper, of which more later, conductor and all-round musical star, Steve Bingham. Steve, welcome.
That's one of the nicest introductions I've ever had, I think.
Well, let's see if it gets any better or worse. I should declare an interest here. I've known Steve for many years, and I have had the great good fortune of collaborating with him over those years on many different projects and shows and so on and so forth. But I thought I'd start by just asking you, Steve, where do you come from? Where were you born and who were your parents?
Oh, goodness.
Well, who are your parents?
Yeah, well, I was actually born down near Poole in Dorset on the south coast of the UK. But my parents moved up to Banbury, which is right in the middle of the country, about as far away from the sea as I think you can get in England. When I was about 6 months old. So basically I'm from Banbury because that's where I spent my entire youth until I left home to go to music college.
And you went to music college because, or rather I should say, I think I know, don't I, that you had decided from a very early age that the violin was your future, your destiny. Is that right?
It's a strange one really because I started playing some music when I was about six, playing the recorder. It was the era when they still did whole class recorder playing in schools. I think that's less and less the case these days. And at one point, a violin teacher came into the classroom and said, you know, I've got some spaces. Does anybody want to learn the violin? And my then best friend, I think I was seven at this point, my then best friend, who was called Gareth, said, "Oh, I'll have violin lessons." And I thought, "Well, if he's going to do it, I'll do it." And he gave up, and I kept going. So in a way, it's a somewhat strange, coincidental thing that I ended up playing the violin. The interesting thing, I suppose, is that neither of my parents played an instrument. My sister tried the violin and gave up very quickly because I'd already progressed a bit, and I think she found that a bit daunting. My dad liked listening to classical music, particularly opera, but as I say, neither of them played anything. And my cousins, my mum's sister's children, they both played cello and piano, and one carried on cello as an amateur and is still playing, and the other one, Colin, became a music teacher and a composer, and has done very well as a composer. Neither of their parents played musical instruments either. So I sort of have no idea where this music thing came from. I think all the parents involved were very encouraging, but there was certainly no practical music making in the family, even in the grandparents. So maybe that's an interesting one. I don't quite know how that works really.
Can you remember, I mean, it's difficult to go back to when you were seven, but can you remember at what stage you got the bug, if you see what I mean? Because starting an instrument is just starting an instrument, but in order for it to work, you have to sort of get the bug, and it has to give you something very special.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I think partly it's now too long ago, and it's very hard to put myself back into that mindset. I've got kids that are now early 30s and late 20s, and when they were 10, 11 years old, which was when I decided I wanted to seriously do the violin, they had no clue what they wanted to do. And I think that's probably true of most kids of that age. But I can't quite put my finger on why it was. You know, at that stage, I'd been playing for three and a half years. And somehow I knew that this was what I wanted to do. But the actual point where that happened, I find that very hard to pin down. And certainly, as you said, quite rightly, starting an instrument, any instrument, I think possibly particularly a string instrument, is not a fun process at the beginning necessarily, because it sounds pretty horrid.
But of course, children don't really know that it sounds horrid. Well, I mean, that's one advantage.
Maybe, I don't know, but I remember being mortified once when I was at some social gathering and was asked to play something. And the two teenage girls who were daughters of one of the friends who were at this social gathering basically said within my hearing how scratchy and horrible it was. You know, it's a bit mortifying. funny the things you remember, you know. I've forgotten a lot of very good things that people have said to me, but I remember that.
We have a habit of remembering the criticisms, don't
true,
we?
True, true, very true. So I don't really know, but I decided for whatever reason that that was what I wanted to do. But I think I maybe had an aptitude to do with the way my brain works for the coordination needed with the hands or whatever. Perhaps. I think it's very hard to say. But anyway, I decided that's what I wanted to do, age 10 and a half.
And so when you got to the end of your schooling, age, I guess, 18 or something, you went on to music college, I think.
Yeah, I mean, we looked... I mean, my parents, again, were very supportive, and we looked at specialist music schools for when I went into secondary school. And I did audition for various places, got a couple of places at... I got a place at Cheetham, got a place at the Purcell School. And Oxfordshire County Council were not prepared to give a grant to anywhere outside their area. And so for a couple of years I went to a lovely school in Tame in Oxfordshire called Lord Williams School, which did have a very good music department, and a lovely head of music called Robin Nelson. And that was a very formative couple of years, actually, because I was in a department where it was relatively small but very thriving, and there was lots of good music making going on, but I was sort of the youngest and obviously had some aptitude for violin, and I was doing quite well, so I got thrown in doing a lot of things perhaps earlier than I would otherwise have had a chance to make music, and it was just a very lively department. But after a couple of years there, I think, and it was boarding, which wasn't that suited to boarding, if I'm honest. After a couple of years there, I think my parents thought this possibly wasn't the best thing. So I actually left there and went back to the comprehensive school in Banbury for the rest of my comprehensive career. It was a more difficult musical atmosphere, but I got the chance to play with a lot of the local amateurs, I led the local symphony orchestra, did all sorts of things. So basically, I had a lot of opportunities during my teens.
So when you finished school, you did get into the academy. Was that difficult to achieve, or what?
I don't. that's a difficult question, because if I say I don't think so, it means I'm very cocky and I knew I was going to get in. It didn't feel. It felt like it was the right progression. To go to one of the London conservatoires. The academy was the obvious choice because my then teacher, Michael Bockman, had been there, and the teacher that he had learnt with had been teaching at the academy but had basically just retired. But there were still very good teachers there, so we thought about who I might go to when I was there, which turned out to be Emmanuel Hurwitz. And I went to the academy and had 4 years.
I've heard this about the academy and the other musical conservatoires in London. I mean, it is quite high pressure, isn't it? Because everyone there is a young, gifted musician, or someone. They've all got aptitude in that sense.
I think there's a difference between a school that operates trying to find the best of the best when they are young teenagers, to an institution that operates post 18, where it's a wider group of people, wider group of instruments, rather than a very specialist school. And I think, certainly in my mind, that's made it a little bit easier. So although at the Royal Academy of Music, they were obviously trying to get the best out of the students and perhaps produce soloists, the reality is that very few people go on to become top soloists. Most of the people in the academy, whether they wanted that or not, are going to end up playing in orchestras, playing in ensembles, teaching, and very few are going to end up as top flight soloists. I mean, that's just the way it is. I was not going to be a top flight soloist, but having learnt from a teacher pre the academy and then a teacher at the academy, both of whom had basically been string quartet players, I basically went along with this string quartet mentality. That's what I wanted to do.
We'll come to that in a minute, did you enjoy your time at the academy?
Yes, I think so.
It was consequential for you in one other particular way, obviously.
yes, I met my wife. I'm only hesitating because, to be perfectly honest with you, I have a terrible memory. And a lot of it is so blurred now. I remember lots of good things that were social. I remember quite a lot of good concerts that I thoroughly enjoyed. I remember a few moments that I didn't enjoy. But I think at the end of the day, I got a lot out of it. And possibly the biggest thing that I got out of it was working outside the confines of the academy whilst I was a student. In other words, getting involved with groups outside, getting involved with doing outside concerts, basically building up the beginnings of a freelance portfolio. It was the right place. I was in London. There was a lot of music going on in London. There were some key people in the academy that I met at the time, not just students, but some of the professors as well, who I went on to work with outside once I left. I think it set me up for A, the potential for a freelance career, and B, the possibility of doing a string quartet career, because I formed a string quartet while I was there. I mean, string quartet, for those who don't know, it's two violins, a viola and a cello, four players. It's a very rich repertoire, and it's a very intimate form of music making, because you don't have a conductor, you don't have lots of people on stage, there's the four of you interacting together, and that has to be a very, very... I mean, people have described it as a four-way marriage. You know, it's a very close grouping if you want to make a string quartet work. There were two, for me, key moments that made me realise that was what I really wanted to spend a reasonable amount of my playing career doing. The first was when I went to my teacher, Michael Bachman's parents' house, in Burford, in the Cotswolds, for a day of quartet playing. I think he just suggested that this would be a fun thing to do. And so he, at that stage, Michael's only 10 years older than me. He was quite a new teacher, but very, very analytical, very careful to be getting it right, teaching. And at that stage, he had two promising pupils, myself and a girl called Fiona. And so we came along and we played violin parts for the quartet. Michael played viola, and one of his father, who was a cello teacher, very good cellist, one of his father's pupils came and played cello. And we had a day working, and we started off on a quartet by Mozart, one of the very famous quartets. It's got the nickname The Dissonance because it has a very complex and rather advanced for its time slow introduction. And we spent about the first 2 hours of this session working on this slow introduction, and it was an absolute eye-opener, because we looked at the detail of the tuning, the intonation, We looked at the detail of the phrasing, how the notes fitted together, and it absolutely stayed with me, and I loved it. I really did. The other moment was a concert that I went to. I'm thinking it was a lunchtime concert, but I can't quite remember, with Michael's quartet, the original Bachman quartet. And they played, I can't remember what the other work, there would have been probably two works in the concert. Can't remember what the other work was, but the one that absolutely hit me in the face was the fifth quartet by Béla Bartók, Hungarian 20th century composer. I did not know at that point that music like that existed. It was, again, an absolute revelation. There was this fantastic soundscape coming into my ears from four people a few feet away, and I absolutely loved it. And so I think that just made me want to do chamber music, and so I was lucky enough to spend quite a lot of my career playing string quartet.
Let's move on from the academy. You finished the academy. Where were you at as you left the academy, if you see what I mean? Musically, I'm right, aren't I, that you'd formed your quartet, so you were ready to take on a sort of professional musical career.
Yeah. As I left the academy, we sort of got a quartet, a group of four people that were working well together. We'd had various slightly varying combinations while we were students, and that's quite normal, I think. But we got to a sort of fairly steady group of four players. This was 1985. And for 8 years, 7, 8 years until 1993, we were the same four. And in that time, we did several recordings. We did a lot of concerts around the UK and abroad and got quite busy. And then we, in 1993, we had a new second violin and a new cellist, which is, for me, was a big upheaval. I had rather naively thought, looking at, for instance, the most famous quartet in those days, the Amadeus Quartet, who had been the same four people for 40 years. I rather naively thought that we would do that and this would be my career. And when then two people decide to leave and you're down to a viola and a first violin, then it does rather rock your world a little bit. But having then found two people who are still with the quartet today, I think, you know, you just have to accept that these things happen. It is, as I said earlier on, quite a rarefied atmosphere in a quartet. And at the end of the day, I think there are two ways of looking at it. There are quartets you hear stories of that argue all the time, but make fantastic music, go on different flights to concerts, sit in different corners of the hotel breakfast room, and so on and so forth. I've never been that sort of person. I want to actually be able to go out for a drink with the people afterwards. Coupled with the fact that I'm married to the viola player, does somewhat mean that that's sort of de rigueur, really. And we are still talking to each other. Yeah. So I think that I was always... And maybe, does that mean we make less good music because we don't argue as much? We still discuss it, we still analyse. It's just a different approach. So we got the original four, 1993. We had two changes and we've carried on since then. And we were very busy in the 90s. And I think by about the turn of the century, by about 2000, 99, 2000, I started getting interested in other sorts of music making. And so the quartet has carried on, but it's not been the be-all and end-all of my career, because I got interested in other things as well. In the late 90s, I met a couple of people who were doing non-classical, should we say, world music. In particular, a jazz flamenco guitarist called Jason Carter. And he introduced me to some other musicians, some classical Indian musicians. We played in a group called Ragatal for a while, which was tabla, bass guitar, acoustic flamenco guitar and violin. I bought an electric violin, and that was one of the catalysts that got me to buy this electric violin. And then sort of it just went from there. The guy who was playing bass guitar, a chap called Steve Lawson, in that original group was into looping, live looping, which is where you use a loop pedal or software to record layers and add layers and so on. I mean, everybody's heard of it now because Ed Sheeran's done it on stage.
But it's basically you record what you're playing and then you play that back and play on top of it.
Sort of and you can take loops away, you can add them, you can, you know, and there are loads of different ways of doing looping. But I sort of got into that and I just sort of generally started getting interested in, I'd always been interested to listen to other forms of music, but I hadn't had a chance to play them. And then, you know, that widened out. I started doing some looping. I met a couple of guys who were in various rock groups. They said, oh, do you want to, you've got an electric fiddle, can you come and play along? And I got involved in some other art, prog rock things. And found I really enjoyed it, you know. So I think that there was this movement of my career in a outward branching, broader direction, which I certainly hadn't seen coming if you'd said that to me in 1989 or something.
And I know, of course, because of the work we've done, that you do a lot of this looping and we've mixed that with poetry and so on. But there's also, you've also sort of branched out now and you do quite a lot of conducting.
Yeah, that was a bit unexpected in a way. I had a little stint teaching the Colchester Institute as head of strings. And so I felt very comfortable coaching chamber music, but less competent and capable when it came to one-to-one teaching. But again, it was a branching out of the career. And I did it for about 7 years. When I was first there, they had a little orchestra and we got string orchestras together. And so I started doing a little bit of conducting. And I think it just went from there. I discovered that I rather enjoyed conducting. It's gone on from there. And I've done some string orchestra groups and then several amateur symphony orchestras, two of which I now conduct regularly, and thoroughly enjoy it. It's another different branching out.
This is what I know about you. So you do your classical playing and that's work for you. The quartet still exists and that's work for you, but it's less intense than it used to be. You do quite a lot of looping concerts and solo shows and things like that. You conduct. And you've also got various other areas you're involved in, like web design and editing, this, that and the other. I wonder if you could just describe, before we get to the sort of heart of this, I wonder if you could just describe a typical week or month, the sort of life you lead. I know it's a difficult one because it's fairly eclectic.
Describing a typical week is to say there is no typical week.
Okay.
So if I look at the last month, I've had a concert yesterday with one of the amateur orchestras I conduct in King's Lynn. So we had rehearsals for that. Big concert, big programme, a lot of work, a lot of preparation. The quartet had a quite major concert up in Kendal in the north of England. And so we had rehearsals for that. I'm just starting to record a new solo CD. So I've been in my friend's studio, Mark, who's a wonderful sound engineer, been recording pieces for that. And these are pieces that have been written specially for me. Behind that, I've got the sort of admin of sometimes arranging concerts. I've arranged a little Christmas concert in Ely. So I've got the admin for sort of, do I design a little flyer for that? How do I get that publicity out there? And then I'm doing some general admin work. You mentioned editing. I edit a local magazine here, do the layout for it. And I work for a thing called the European String Teachers Association, doing some of their website updates and keeping it running, the technical side of it, because I've always been into computers and things. So it's just a mix of all that, really.
So all of that, I happen to know that you also have quite a challenging domestic situation, you and your wife looking after an elderly relative, caring for an elderly relative. So that's the kind of the whole tranche of kind of Steve Bingham's life.
Yeah, he's pretty intense at times.
It can be quite intense at times. Now, the question is, because it seems to me, as one of those amateur musicians, I kind of envy your life in some ways and the level at which you play and so on and so forth. Because you do so many different things, maybe you don't need a hinterland. In other words, the place you go to slough off all the troubles, a place that gives you some kind of, can I use the word spiritual? Yes, I'll use that, satisfaction, peace, whatever you want. Would I be right in that, or do you indeed need such a place of escape, or an occupation of escape?
I think one definitely needs that place. I think that the slight blurriness of it for someone like me is that when I'm doing certain bits of my music making, they never feel like work, because I really love it. You know, I really enjoy doing it. So learning the new solo pieces that I'm learning for the CD, or practicing a new loop piece, that in a way feels like a relaxation. But it isn't quite, because there's always that pressure of trying to be analytical and get it right. So I think there is that side of it that I always wanted to have music as not just a job, but something that I enjoy doing. And I still do, which is great. But I think one always needs something else. And for me, I go out in the countryside and I take my binoculars and my camera and I look at birds.
Why?
Oh, there's a good one. Well, my dad was very into natural history. He was a horticulturalist, and his hobby was bird watching, or birding, as I'm of an age where I still call it bird watching. Any birders listening to this will be saying, oh, it's birding. No, it's not, it's bird watching. Anyway, whatever. Aged about 13, he said, we're going to go up to, weird that I now live on the North Norfolk coast, but at the time I'd never been there. And he said, we're going to go up to King's Lynn and we're going to do some bird watching for a weekend with a couple of friends of his along the North Norfolk coast. And we stayed in the, and so he said, do you want to come? And I said, yeah, why not? You know, so we stayed in the youth hostel at King's Lynn, and we did a weekend of bird watching, and I just got the bug. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was the fact that I'd never seen any of these things. I didn't realise how much variety there was out there. We saw something like 100 different species in a weekend. So there was possibly, for my OCD, there was that sort of listing, the twitching, as they call it, the ticking mentality, although I don't like twitching. I just enjoy watching behaviour and seeing the birds. And I just got interested from there.
So if you take your binoculars and your camera out, and I've sort of seen you slightly in action doing that, what's going on? Is that more than music, or maybe the same? Is that do you get into that state where the whole world kind of disappears and it's totally centered in on this? Is it a kind of meditation, or is it more practical than that? I'm probably asking the wrong questions, but I'm trying to, because I know it gives you enormous pleasure, and I'm trying to work out what kind of pleasure it gives you, and why you do it, and whether it's, maybe it isn't an escape at all, maybe it's just another thing you do.
I think it is an escape, because I think that what you can do, or what I do when I'm out in the countryside, is, yes, I'm maybe looking to take some nice photos of a bird or a landscape or whatever, and yes, I'm maybe going to somewhere that I think there might be some interesting birds that I haven't seen for a while that I can look at, and I can enjoy the behaviour, the plumage, whatever. But as I say, I keep records of what I see, but I'm not an inveterate ticker, and I don't run from one bird to the next and jump in the car to go and see a rare bird. It's nice if you see something you haven't seen before, and in certain circumstances I would pop in the car if I can and try and get to see something, but I don't go out of my way to do that. I just enjoy being out in nature. This is perhaps the key thing, actually, that identifying the birds that are out there and seeing them, and in recent years trying to photograph them, gives me an excuse to go out in nature, in the countryside, where I relax almost by default. Because if I'm out walking and I've got my ears and my eyes very much on what can I hear, what can I see, I am not thinking about any of the other problems, if you want to call them that, of my normal life. Not to say there are huge numbers of problems, but you know, you just forget about it. It takes over a little bit. And even if you see nothing, or there's not much around, you're still just walking out there in the countryside. And I do some of my best thinking out there as well. You know, that, you know, I'm just, the brain goes into a little bit of neutral. And maybe you pop up with some little idea of something that you'd like to do musically or whatever. That sounds like that's slightly contradictory, that I'm not.
But you're not thinking about
work.
I'm
not sort of thinking about work, the things that I am doing. I may be thinking about, oh, I could, you know, there's something new I could do, or there's a little project.
And that's literally an idea that can pop into your head.
Yeah, because you have a little bit of space for it.
I've been with you on occasions when you've looked up at the sky and said, oh, that's a, and you've named a bird. Mm. And I can't actually see anything at all.
Well, that might say more about your eyesight than your bird-watching skills.
And the other thing that always amazes me, and of course there are many classical composers who've noticed this, is that you can hear a tiny little fragment of birdsong that, again, is almost inaudible to me because I'm not open to it and ready for it. And you can say, and again, you can identify a bird from the song.
Part of the enjoyment is gradually getting better at these things. And it's like anything else, maybe. I mean, maybe it's like music. It's practice. It's training. It's training yourself to recognise things. And I think you train in music as well. You train to get more accurate at where you place your fingers, or more accurate in your hearing. And I think it's the same with a hobby like bird watching. You're training yourself. You see something and you think, I wonder what that is. And then maybe you get a bit of a better view, and you then can recognise the species. And then you say, ah, right, so that particular mode of flight or that particular bit of behaviour is associated with that bird. You maybe go back and you look in your books and you see, oh, yes.
Let's try an experiment. This may not work. to finish with, a few quick fire things. So concert hall or countryside?
Oh, you can't do that to me. Oh,
I can try.
Oh, concert hall.
Okay. Notes or birds?
See, music's going to win out. Notes. Music is going to win out here because it's been my entire career. But I feel like I'm failing the birds now. I feel like I'm letting them down.
Yes. Sorry, birds.
Oh, they don't care.
One last thing, which is sort of very tied up with this conversation. But I can't remember, I don't know whether it was in Thailand or somewhere in Southeast Asia, at a teacher's conference, and I met a teacher, I would say in her late 40s or something like that, an English teacher, an English woman teaching English, and we got talking, and it turned out she was a professional viola player. Cue viola joke, but we're not going to do those because I get sensitive. For the listeners here, I am myself a rather poor but passionate viola player, amateur viola player. But that's neither here nor there. So my ears pricked up and I said, oh, how interesting. And it turned out that I can't remember now what had happened, but she'd had some injury and had had to, from one minute to the next, abandon her professional viola playing career. She played in some top orchestra. I think it could have been the Covent Garden Orchestra or something. I can't remember. But it was a proper orchestra. And I said, horrified, as an amateur musician, oh my God, but don't you miss it? I mean, that must be awful. And she said, no, I don't miss it at all. You just change and you move on. And now I'm doing something else. I'm having a really good time. Could that be you?
I in my current frame of mind, if I had to stop playing the violin tomorrow, I think I would find that pretty tough, because I'm really enjoying some of the music making I'm doing. But I guess you move on, and maybe that's the advantage of having other interests. I've got interests in technology, I've got interests in natural history and photography and so on.
We should really end by listening to you playing some music. And so the question is, and this is, I'm springing this on you, but the question is, of the many recordings you've done, can you say which one would best give people an idea of who you are? Which is also a very difficult question, but it occurs to me that it might be interesting to hear your reply.
Yes, you ask some difficult questions, Jeremy. One day I'm going to turn the tables. I think, given what we've talked about, that what it would be nice to do would be to find a piece of music which combines my interest in non-classical or broader types of music with the fact that I love playing string quartets, with the fact that I'm interested in technology. And I just was quickly running that through my brain, and the obvious one to me would be one of the set of pieces that we commissioned from my friend Phil Toms a few years ago, arrangements of some film music scores by Michael Nyman for live string quartet and pre-recorded string quartets, which we pre-recorded. And we play them live.
And so what you have,
so speaker. You have the speakers with the backing tracks coming out, which is our own recordings of ourselves playing these other quartets, and then a live quartet on stage, and it becomes this bigger, almost orchestral soundscape. And so I think perhaps one of those pieces. I don't mind which one. You can choose, Jeremy. There are five.
Steve, thank you very much for being the first guest on this podcast. And let's play ourselves out with Steve and the Bingham Quartet, both live and pre-recorded, playing a piece by Michael Nyman. Listening to a piece called Knowing the Ropes by Michael Nyman from his score for the 1988 film Drowning by Numbers. It's played by the Bingham String Quartet. Thank you very much for listening to this podcast. See you next time. Thank you.